This podcast is supported by Spotify. President Barack Obama and Bruce Springsteen have a new podcast. And right now, you can listen to Renegades Born in the USA exclusively on Spotify. In the podcast, longtime friends President Obama and Springsteen sit down to discuss the country that's given them both so much, chronicle the stories of its people, and connect their own search for meaning, truth, and community with a larger story of America. Listen free, only on Spotify.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast. Anybody who says my show is neat has to go. Of music, news, and criticism, I am your host, John Caramonica. You were listening to a little bit of Billie Eilish. It's called No Time to Die. It's the Bond song, came out last year. We're talking about pop star documentaries this week. I wanted to listen to that song because that song provides a kind of interesting plot point in the recent Billie Eilish documentary, which is on Apple Plus or whatever the Apple film streaming service is. There's a scene where Billie is recording vocals and is like doing like a super serious vocal. And then she's complaining to Phineas about having to do that vocal. And she's going to get made fun of on the internet for like, I don't know, for like trying hard or something. Anyway, it's like a very revealing moment in a documentary that I think is mostly good, although I don't know how revealing it is, but it's mostly good. But it got me thinking about the tension between who's in control here. Is the pop star in control? Is the label in control? Is the director in control? Is the streaming service in control? And why are there so many pop star documentaries? There are so many of them. I spent yesterday watching the Mendes film. I watched the Blackpink film, all the Demi episodes, just enough Ariana to know that I didn't need to watch the rest of the Ariana film. I've been watching all these films, and when I was thinking of someone to bring on this episode, I was like, I need someone who has watched all these films. Because to be frank, there are plenty of reasons not to watch all these films. And I was like, surely someone has thought about this as a subgenre of cinema. And what do you know? Simran Hans is here. Simran, hello.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Happy to have you. Simran is a freelance writer, a film critic for The Observer, living in London.
Yes.
Big, as podcast fans know, big fan of London.
And we're a big fan of podcasts as well.
Hey! Whenever I get on a plane again, my reverse homecoming to London at the airport, I'm expecting like a big thing. Okay,
so exactly. Just no pressure. It's going to be me, you, Laura Snapes.
Hey, shout out Laura Snapes.
Shout out Laura Snapes.
So Simran wrote a piece, and not only did Simran write a piece about this stripe of documentary, she did it last year. So just like way early in front of a bunch of the other stuff, in front of the Billie Doc and kind of a bunch of the other ones that have come out. It's I feel like the last 12 months have been kind of like a feverish pace. So we are going to talk about this category of film. We're going to talk about its uses. We are going to talk about, is it cinema or is it promo? I have some casual thoughts about taxonomizing these films, but let's start right off the rip. Simran, in your piece, you wrote about these films, but you also wrote about like some older, like, or rather music documentaries that were more historically minded, which I'm not too interested in right now. But it does bring up the question, why would someone, a famous person, allow themselves to be the subject of a documentary film, presumably intrusive, although obviously there are caveats with that, at this early stage of a career? Why are these films, do you think, getting made in year one, year three, rather than year 10, year 20?
Well, I think like the answer is different depending on the star. The context shifts differently depending on who we're talking about. Billie Eilish, I guess, is like the thing that comes to mind because she is sort of on the ascent or kind of in her imperial period. And that is why...
I should use that more, imperial period. Okay, good. I like it.
I feel like she has risen so fast. And what's so good about the Billie Eilish documentary is that it captures that ascent. And I think that's what a lot of these films are trying to do. They're trying to capture the rise. You get it a little bit in the Blackpink documentary as well.
When I think about those two films specifically, the Billie one and the Blackpink one, when we get into the taxonomy stuff later, I think they're in the same rung, which is to say young or youngish new stars who have come of age in an era in which they are always being filmed and scrutinized anyway. So perhaps the presence of a documentary camera or three does not add to the baseline anxiety of being on camera all the time. Like, the camera doesn't feel quite as intrusive sometimes.
I'm going to jump in and complicate your argument, John, because yes. What about the Shawn Mendes documentary? Because he's... Well, I know. Maybe the less said about that one, the better.
Speaking of uncomplicating arguments, but yes, go, please continue.
Well, I was just going to say he's kind of similar age to the stars that we're talking about. Obviously, Billy's on the younger end, but we're talking about digital natives, Gen Zs, people who have grown up with the internet and are comfortable filming themselves and being filmed all the time. So maybe he has to kind of go in that category as well.
I think from a film perspective, yes. From an actually potentially interesting perspective, the Shawn Mendes of all these movies, and I just want to run down a list of all of them really quick, which I think we both have watched. And this is of the most recent crop, not even going back like 5 years or whatever. Shawn Mendes in Wonder, Blackpink, Light Up the Sky, Ariana Grande, Excuse Me, I Love You, the Demi Lovato Dancing with the Devil YouTube doc series, the Justin Bieber Seasons or something, the YouTube Seasons. Doc series, Taylor Swift, Miss Americana, Taylor Swift Folklore, the Long Pond Studio Sessions, Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry. We could go on, but those are the main ones we're going to focus on. Mendes of that rung of film was in the toughest position for me, because I felt like he was an artist who was trying to be presented as serious, but the film didn't do very much to achieve that, even though the kind of toolkit was applied to him, kind of in a way that in the Ariana film, or at least the parts I could get through, there wasn't really much effort to offer insight into her interior life. It really is just like a concert film with some like bonus footage where they think that they're ripping off Madonna, Truth or Dare, but they're not. So there's a little bit of that. But with Shawn Mendes, there's a sense of like, this is a serious film, capital S, capital F, but like nothing in it lives up to the seriousness.
I guess we can sort of get into the tropes that cut across all of them. Fame's lonely. A lot of eyeballs on you means there's a lot of pressure. Touring is physically grueling. But also, like, the kind of main thing that cuts across all of these different films is this idea of relatability. And I think what's interesting in kind of talking about them as a set is the way that relatability is kind of nuanced across the different examples. And I think how successful they are kind of depends on sort of how much you buy what they're selling you, right? If we see these films as a branding exercise, how convincing it is the sale. For Shawn Mendes, you know, the arc of that film is his anxiety and his perfectionism kind of becomes this prison. And that's what makes him relatable to us and hopefully likable. And listen, he's a very handsome, I'm sure very nice man, but he's not that interesting.
Yeah, I will say, musically, I really like Shawn Mendes' earlier stuff. This would be a great moment to play just a hit of Treat You Better. Just a hit. Just a like, touch of it. I know I can treat you better than he can. And any girl like you deserves a gentleman. Tell me, why are we wasting time on... So I really enjoy early Shawn Mendes. I will say, the way that the camera in this film loves Shawn Mendes is far beyond anything I could possibly even pretend to like about Shawn Mendes. Like, and I like Shawn Mendes. But of all of the films, this one I felt like occasionally bordered on the kind of erotic in terms of its fixation on Shawn Mendes as a physical specimen. That I found very eye-opening. There were moments I thought were just like uncommonly intimate's not even the right word, like kind of gawkerish in moments.
John, are you talking about the scene in which him and Camila Cabello perform slow dancing in a burning room in a bathroom? That was also my reaction as well.
Yeah. Why are those scenes so uncomfortable?
Why are they there? You know, like...
Right, but why... Okay, I know why they're there, because with all kidnappings, you need proof of life. This is that. right? Like, this is that. Okay, so that's why it's there. Why is it so uncomfortable?
It's the performance of spontaneity, right? I think in all of these films, we're looking for an authenticity. We're looking for access. We're looking to be given what we sort of don't normally see or we can't consume via social media. And so in these behind the scenes moments, you get these snatches of intimacy. And I think the reason why this particular scene is so excruciating, and it is excruciating, because it feels so fake.
Yes. In the Billy film, Billy obviously knows there's always cameras around, but you rarely come away feeling that she has much concern or anxiety about what the camera's capturing. Blackpink, it's more formal structurally. It's more formal. But again, I don't pick up loads of camera awareness or anxiety during the ostensibly casual filming. With Shawn Mendes, I always felt that he understood that the cameras were there, and Camilla as well. And actually, there was one spectacular moment in the Mendes film. It's literally the only note I took in the entire movie, the only thing I typed out. When they go back to his old apartment in Toronto, you know, it's maybe like halfway through the film or a little bit before halfway through the film, his apartment, not his family's house, but like the apartment that he lives. It's like an apartment, you know, like an apartment building.
Yeah, an apartment that's clearly never been slept in.
Yes. So when they go there, do you remember the first thing he does when he walks into the apartment?
No, I watched it drunkenly on New Year's Eve, so I don't remember that
then
particular
you
might
have even missed this. He walks over to, I don't know if it was like a mantle or like a piano, like some kind of shelf, right? And he takes a photo in a small frame, grabs it, and then walks to like a closet in the back of the apartment and like throws it in the closet. And I was like, who's in that photo? Like, is that an ex-girlfriend? God. Is that a family member? Is that like him as a 9-year-old? Like, what is it? And I was like, this is the only honest moment in the film. And I was actually stunned that they kept it in. As he was doing that, he was kind of talking his way through the apartment. Like, oh, it's great to be here. Like, this is, you know, like, I can't believe I've been here. So I guess they kept it for that purpose because he's narrativizing the return. But in my mind, the only thing I could see is him trying to be slick and taking this thing out of the camera's eye and putting it somewhere where it can't be seen. And
that's
I was like, that's the real Shawn Mendes. Whatever that was, that's the real Shawn Mendes.
That's so interesting. I need to read the Reddit thread about that.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. You write about film broadly speaking, not simply film made by extremely well-paid pop stars. What do you make of this batch of films cinematically? Do you enjoy the camera work? Do you feel that they're structurally sound? How do you feel about the cinematography, the color palettes? You know, what if anything, jumps out at you about either these films as a category or individually?
These films are massively varied in quality, and they're also like quite varied in style. So, for example, the Demi Lovato documentary, which is a sort of split across 4 episodes and is on YouTube, that one is very glossy, very stylized. You have a lot of talking heads, which normally I kind of don't love in documentary. I find it doesn't draw me in. I don't find it as immersive as a kind of pure verite style film. But then it works because of her candidness and sort of her
charisma.
Right,
of what they're talking about. Yeah, it's like we're talking about heroin. It's like, yeah, I'm gonna listen to that.
Well, exactly. And because the subject material is so intense and so serious, it almost feels like the sort of structured nature of the sit-down interview makes it safer, makes it feel more consensual, makes it feel kind of more on her terms rather than sort of being fly on the wall. I think that's definitely a strategy in that particular film. I think it's really interesting that probably two of the best films of all of these docs that we're talking about are Miss Americana and Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry. Both of those films are directed by different filmmakers, but edited by the same person, by this documentary editor called Lindsay Utz. I don't know if I'm saying her name right, but she is brilliant. And I think there are similarities between those two films and the sort of the nuance of the editing.
Yeah, can you tease that out a little bit? See, people say you don't learn anything on podcasts. I just learned something. Tell me about the way editing functions in those films.
You have to think about when you're being presented with Verite footage, with fly on the wall footage, it's not just being presented to you as is. It's not like you're watching an Instagram live and you're getting the image as it's coming out unedited. Things are chopped and moved around and cut and pasted to create tension and to create narrative. And I just think that's done so brilliantly, particularly in the Billie Eilish film. And the way that the sort of Justin Bieber parallel is structured in the film, I think, is so smart. So that's
the real Justin Bieber documentary. Forget the YouTube thing. Like, the real Justin Bieber documentary is the B plot in the Billie Eilish documentary.
Exactly. And so for anyone who hasn't seen it, I mean, it's brilliant. You should definitely watch that. I'm not particularly sort of knowledgeable about Billie Eilish, and I cried my eyes out in that film and came out of it feeling like I was a fan and like she was mine, you know, when I went into it being totally ambivalent about her. And I think it just really captures her personality. But yeah, for anyone who hasn't seen it, the Justin Bieber arc is kind of teased out through the film, and she's compared to him because, you know, he was also discovered on YouTube and very young kind of child star, achieved astronomical fame, and then had this sort of fall from grace, which she hasn't had yet. And she talks about being obsessed with him as a 12-year-old, and he's her first love. And, you know, he's the sort of object of her fandom. And she understands how her fans relate to her because she's had this experience herself. And I think that is so smart to kind of contrast those two things. That tells us so much about how she perceives herself and the world that she fits in. I gave you attention when nobody else was paying. I gave you the shirt off my back, what you're saying, to keep you warm. I showed you the game everybody else was playing. That's for sure. That's for sure. And I was on my knees when nobody else was playing.
I'm Jenna Wortham.
I'm Wesley Morris.
We are two culture writers at the New York Times, and we host a podcast called Still Processing.
And every week, we talk about the way popular culture connects to life. And right now, we're talking about the N-word.
A word that my most rebellious youthful self loved using, but recently just started to feel curdled coming out of my mouth.
I've never used it.
I still can't believe that.
I mean, it's been used on me, but I have never used it. We're going deep into why in this episode and into our cultural relationship with this word, too.
It's an awful word, and yet it's still with us after all this time, and how we use it is still debated, even in our friendship.
So we talk about that, too.
You can listen to Still Processing wherever you get your podcasts.
And you can listen to this episode right now.
I liked the Billie Eilish film. I had some reservations about it. I don't know that I loved the film. And I think part of what was a wall for me was, and it's something I mentioned at the end of my review, this is a product of Interscope Records. And it's presented as a documentary directed by a R.J. Cutler, a well-regarded filmmaker who apparently was given Final Cut of the film from some reporting that I didn't do, but I read. Any tension is very mild. It still feels like a publicity portrait. On this topic, I also just should briefly shout out Danny Funt. Danny is a writer who wrote a piece about documentary and the ways in which documentary is evolving in the streaming era. And he briefly alludes to this label problem in his piece. So Danny, shouts out to you. And it got me thinking a lot about the use of documentary film as a tool of publicity. And these things are paid for by Apple or Netflix. They are big financial opportunities for these stars. And I wonder if that struck you at all, that documentary film as a category is like loosely being co-opted. And of course, we could talk more broadly about how that's been true for decades. But I mean, in this specific set of cases, the idea of like documentary film and artists being a subject of a serious film, it's really just another tool and weapon in a promotional arsenal.
I don't know if I fully agree with you. Yes, you have to acknowledge the commercial stake that everybody has in it. Amazon, Netflix, Apple TV, Disney Plus, YouTube, they're all investing in these kind of documentaries, right? And so it's mutually beneficial for the streamer, for the label, for the star. But I guess the way I see it is that even though all of those things can be true and there can be a kind of commercial imperative, I still think sometimes the art kind of sneaks through. And I felt that with the Billie Eilish film, even though, yes, she comes off very well, and as a promotional piece, it's incredibly effective. You know, I just said to you, I'm a new fan after watching it. So if the job is to market her, it's done the job really well. But I think that there's a story being told, and I think there's something being revealed about her personality. And I think that doesn't happen in all of them. But yeah, they're totally a tool. It's like the problem with documentary in general, though, that people often view documentary form as just a vehicle for a message, or in this case, a vehicle for the artist that they're about, for the subject. And if you look at the individual films, a lot of them are way more interesting than that.
And I think that's why I was asking earlier about the style of these films and like how you feel about them cinematically. Because look, I'm aware enough to understand that there is a craft and a set of established modalities in documentary, but I'm less familiar with the film world than I am with music. And it sort of makes me wonder, like, how much are those modes, in essence, being absorbed and weaponized for non-pure documentary purposes? Not that there's anything such thing as pure documentary. I understand. Yada, 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 yada. But, you know, when I see the Scooter Braun industrial enterprise basically being like, all of your documentary is belong to us, you know, when I see that, it makes me, look, I don't have any desire to make documentaries myself, right? But it makes me think, if I ever did want to make a documentary about a famous person, there'd be no way to do it without having them be a stakeholder, their management, their label, which basically, for me, would undermine the purpose of wanting to do something reportorial or documentary in the first place.
As a critic, you have to believe that the texts that come from the artists themselves are the most valuable and tell us the most about them. And I certainly think that's true for, I don't know, someone like Beyonce, right? You know, she's had several documentaries and none of them are really as revealing as if you sat down and watched her entire videography.
I think that's totally fair. Talk about the Scooter Braun ecosystem, because three of these films are Scooter Braun productions: the Demi, the Bieber, and the Ariana.
Well, it's interesting that we kind of think about these films as sort of PR exercises for the artists. But what struck me was that the Demi Lovato documentary, the Justin Bieber documentary, and to an extent the Ariana Grande documentary are kind of a sort of rehabilitation for Scooter Braun after the sort of Taylor Swift debacle.
Speak on it.
I'm thinking of the Demi Lovato one specifically because I just watched that quite recently. She is talking about all of this incredibly heavy trauma that she's been through. And then you have Scooter presented as a kind of savior and somebody who's swept in at the 11th hour and sort of not let her down. And even when she relapses, he doesn't fire her and he's there for her. And he's being reinforced as this hero character, which is obviously a counter narrative to all the other stuff that's been going on about him in the press.
I think Scooter, having been through the sort of fire with Justin Bieber, separate from the Taylor narrative, but through having kind of gone through all the cycles with Bieber. Let's not forget that Bieber is a pioneer in the documentary space. I mean, I reviewed...
Never say never.
Yeah, I mean, I think I reviewed that when it was commercially released. You know, I think I had to go to a theater on opening night because they didn't do any press screenings for one of the two. I forget if it was Never Say Never or the other one. But this is something that is part of the model. And it actually makes me wonder... I was thinking about this in terms of merchandise earlier today, but I'm like, does what Scooter did with Bieber, which is basically not just feed music, but feed film, does that suggest that there's like marketplace inefficiencies and that really we should have documentaries about every famous person? Like everybody should have a 90-minute Netflix film because there's actually an appetite for them and we're really only just catching up. Like the appetite predates the product. Scooter, I think, was maybe the first to identify that the appetite was there, and then created the product to fill the appetite. And I wonder if more people, even though I'm skeptical of some of this product, I wonder if more people should be doing it. Should we have a Young Thug one of these? Should we have seven Drake films? You know, what do you think?
I think the point that you make about it being another revenue stream for Scooter Braun, like, I think that's true, and it's clever from a business perspective. But I also think the more kind of interesting and the more troubling thread is that, to me, it's the more about his personal stake in it. You know, how does he come across? He is this kind of hero character. And that, I think, is incredibly cynical. It's not just about making money for the enterprise. It's trying to present yourself in a particular way and having your artists contractually corroborate that on film. I think that's a bit troubling.
Contractual corroboration. That's major. That's going to be a hell of a biography title when someone does that 10 years from now. Contractual corroboration. Scooter Braun.
Yeah, who do you
think
will be the whistleblower?
I have some thoughts, but I won't say them on air. Given all the sort of themes that we've been picking up on, we haven't talked about the Blackpink film. I think the Blackpink film is interesting because it deals with all of the things that we're talking about, all the themes. And of all the films, it's actually my favorite film.
Because, interesting.
Yeah, it to me, it does the work cinematically, and it also does the work in terms of what you were describing as the purpose of the Billy film, which is like, it's a marketing, you know, and you're a fan now. To me, as a fan of Blackpink, Jisoo stands, stand up, you know who you are. As a Blackpink fan, a blink, what I took away from it was an actual more robust understanding of the group, even for someone who pays pretty close attention. I learned things that I didn't know. And I also saw things in the film that I was surprised that they allowed to be in a film. K-pop is sort of a notoriously cloistered, tightly controlled narrative world. And obviously, this film is a product of YG, the label, and Netflix. But the story that it told was not as neatly tied up, I felt, as I would have expected going in. I would have thought they wouldn't have talked about being fatigued and burned out on tour. They wouldn't have talked about crying. They wouldn't have talked about how hard the training was that they had to go through. Those are things that we all sort of understand from a distance, but I don't know that I would have expected to see it on camera. And they were being pretty frank about it. What was your vibe on that movie?
It's interesting that you sort of saw those things as a marker of the film's authenticity, because for me, they just sort of fell into the classic pop star documentary trope. And maybe it's because I know less about Blackpink. I kind of know their hit singles, but I don't know too much about their story. And so for me, the through line of the film was, yes, we're a manufactured band, but our chemistry is incredibly real and organic. And I think it took great pains to kind of tell you that. So it's interesting to sort of hear that for you, it didn't scan that way.
I think it's because, like I said, I've been following and writing about them for a while, but also as someone that pays attention to like how the K-pop industry has historically grappled with dissent of any kind, like just even like individual opinions about how challenging the business can be, I was very struck to see a group coming from that world actually have that woven into their public narrative. The tour that they documented in that film in 2019, I went to the Newark show. And I mentioned it in like a notebook I wrote, but I didn't really do like a proper review. I just kind of like threw a couple sentences in there. But I remember thinking when I was at that show, I was like, wow, these performers look very unhappy. Like almost like I once saw a Rihanna show at like MetLife Stadium. And I was just like, wow, she looks not happy to be here. You know, it was like 50,000 people. And she was, I was just like, man, she just doesn't look happy to be here. I had a similar feeling watching Blackpink where I was like, wow, y'all did not look happy to be with these 15,000 fans, like not even a tiny bit. Maybe that's why I sort of felt something peculiar in this film, because they're talking about that tour and how unhappy and broken they were on the tour. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, it connected with...
Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah, connected. And I sort of, at the time, I remember wishing that I was reviewing that concert because I felt like I had a lot to say about Blackpink as a group and also this presentation of something between like boredom and dissatisfaction, you know, on a big stage. That was something that you just don't encounter. I review a lot of concerts. You don't encounter that very much. And so to see that being not only admitted to, but like essentially woven into the story, coming from an industry that typically shies away from stuff like that, I thought it was really striking. And actually, Karen Gans is going to come on later to talk about Demi, but Karen and I were talking earlier, and she reminded me of the scene in the Katy Perry documentary from like the early 2010s, where Katy is like crying over Russell Brand.
Key text, key moment. She ascends slowly to the stage and yes. her smile
and just like turns it on.
Plastered on. Just like turns a Barbie it doll. On.
Hard pivot. And Karen was like, oh, that made me respect her so much. You know, it made me understand, you know, how hard, basically the actual emotional labor of being a pop star at that level. And I rewatched it before we started recording today, and I was moved by it once more. But I was struck how in the Blackpink story, there is no, like, I turned it on for the fans. It's just like, nah, I'm bummed. Like, this is hard. We've been doing this for 100 nights. Like, that's kind of whack.
And I guess that's one of the sort of key things about these films. Does it give you the sense after watching it that you know a little bit more about the star? And if it does, then it's successful. And if it doesn't, then it's not, which is possibly why the Ariana Grande film is so unsatisfying, why you turned it off after 10 minutes. You didn't really miss anything. The film carries on. And I guess that if you had to tease out a narrative, it's that she is doing this tour 2 years after the Manchester attacks, and she's got to sort of pull herself together and deliver after going through this trauma. But that's all subtext. They don't really explicitly refer to any of the stuff that she's been through in her personal life. It's just a sense of heaviness that is alluded to throughout the film.
And she's almost not the main character of the film. The tour is the character, but it's almost like she's not the main character, in very stark contrast to the Shawn Mendes film, where he is like the literal sun, you know? It's like in both radiance and gravitational pull, he is the sun. There's something in the part, at least in the parts of the Ariana film that I got to, where I was like, it's almost incidental. It's like they don't want to get too close to her. That in and of itself is, I think, sort of telling. There's like a cold distance between the camera and Ariana in that film.
Definitely. It's revealing in the sense that it's not revealing at all.
And unlike Billy, who even in the moments where the camera is like filming Billy from a distance or even up close, and she just seems like generally like, whatever, it's fine, sure, whatevs. You get the sense that like Ariana's almost like walking away from the camera, whether literally or figuratively.
But also, like, it's worth saying that they're two very different films, in the sense that the Ariana Grande film is basically a concert film and the Billie Eilish film is a sort of full verite documentary. You get a couple of performance scenes, but the style of it is totally classic fly-on-the-wall documentary, not any talking heads, only interviews and kind of, yeah, shot as it's happening. And so that gives it a different sense of intimacy and a different sense of immediacy, I think.
Can we talk briefly about taxonomy? And then we have to talk about mom, which is to say Taylor. So we have this taxonomy where, and I think Demi and Bieber, the Bieber YouTube series, those two, they're sort of like self-imposed, self-directed behind the musics, you know, except you don't wait till you're 50 to do it. You do it when you're 25 or 27 or whatever. That's like the phase two rung. Like the Billy film, Blackpink, I guess in a way, the Mendes film, that's kind of like, you know, they're promo docs. I was talking to a friend earlier who made a joke about them. He was like, oh yeah, that's like the stuff when you used to buy a CD and you got like a DVD bonus extra and it was like 40 minutes of footage. He's like, that's what those
Taylor
are.
Taylor Swift was very good at those, yes, I thought.
Absolutely. So, but it's not surprising that Taylor is someone who has made, same as Bieber, but who has made films kind of in each of these categories. And Miss Americana to me is like, it's the Demi and Bieber doc masquerading as the Billy doc, kind of. It's like, it's behind the scenes, it's verite, but it is sort of image rehabilitation in a way.
I think image rehabilitation is totally the right way of putting it. It's all about these stars trying to seize their narrative control and kind of reconfigure themselves in the public eye. And, you know, in order for you to be able to do that, a narrative has to already exist. And perhaps you're unhappy with that. And so there's reason to go back and kind of reshape it. It's not like what Billie Eilish is doing, which is being actively involved in shaping that media narrative as she kind of ascends.
Yeah. And also just as a sidebar with the Billie, it's funny how like the one moment of dissent in the Billy film is like someone tweets or comments on an IG post that she was mean at a meet and greet, and it's like driving her nuts because she's someone who is so mindful and aware of the online discourse around her and is trying so mightily to control it, even as it's like a swelling tsunami that you cannot possibly control. But like these tiny small things like send her into overdrive, or even when she's like recording the James Bond song and she's like, the internet's going to make fun of me for singing well or whatever. Horrible. But you know, like, you're right in that here she is, early phase of her career, and already kind of like anticipating counter narratives. Whereas Taylor, who's a little bit older and kind of had to go through the counter narrative phase later, is now in part making a film. Like, I'm sure there's like a beat sheet for that film where it's like things that have to be in the film. Taylor reassesses her politics. Taylor talks about blank. Taylor, you know what I mean? Like, it felt at times a little bit like five things that we need to make sure you know about Taylor Swift, because we think you may have not realized that.
And it's really telling how the Kanye West incident is right up the top. Structurally, that is one of the first things that we kind of learn about her. And it's the axis on which her narrative transformation, or her kind of, I don't know how the best way to put it, but it's the axis on which the film turns, right?
Yeah. You never really forget your first trauma in that sense. When you're a public figure, I think when you sense the narrative like getting out of your hand, when you can't kind of steer it entirely, I think. And again, I know that that was a traumatic thing for Taylor. I don't know if it was traumatic for Ye. I don't think it really was, but I know it was traumatic for Taylor. And so it's not surprising that even 7, 8, 10 years later, however many years have passed, so much of what happens is trying to like set that right, or at least reclaim that. That's still very much active, and it's active in this film for sure.
I think the political stuff is also super interesting. You know, her kind of trying to reassert her credibility as a feminist after the girl boss squad goals era.
I was going to say I don't know, because I think that was always kind of an open question, it seemed. That was like the subject of much debate, I guess I would say.
Yeah, totally. And having her kind of come out as a Democrat and come out in favor of gay rights and advocate for those things where she had been silent, I think a lot of people really wanted her to do that. And I guess what's maybe interesting, or I'm not quite sure of, is how much of that she felt she wanted to do for herself and how much of that she felt she needed to present.
How do you feel about Miss Americana as film? Does it feel effective to you?
I think it's a pretty good movie. I don't think that you quite get the insight that
you pretend to get, or they pretend to give you.
Exactly. I think the verite style, I guess the way Lana Wilson, the director, uses some of Taylor's own home video footage as well is kind of telling. There's inserts of her playing the guitar and, you know, clearly filmed by Joe Alwyn, who is notably kind of pretty much absent from the film, from what I remember.
Yeah, there's like a scene, like maybe after a concert backstage, where she like walks up and like he puts his arm around her or something and they like walk off into the distance. I think that's the extent of it.
Exactly. But he's kind of protected. We don't get any interviews from him. We don't get any footage of them together. And that's the stuff that people really want, right? Even in the Billie Eilish documentary, you get a little bit of her relationship.
Also, I guess I would also contend, in the same way that there is an instrumental purpose to Miss Americana, like it exists to serve a need in the Taylor kind of like narrative reassessment, I feel very similarly about the much less interesting film, which is the Folklore film, which is the Taylor quarantine making these songs and then performing these songs. Obviously, there's not a lot of narrative in this film. There's a little bit of kind of like, here's how we did it. It's mostly song performances, but it does also attempt to recalibrate another part of the Taylor mythology, which is that Taylor went too far into pop. Taylor was too risky on Reputation. Making a movie about the choice to strip down into something more bare, more folk-oriented, more return to roots, that is image management, much in the same way that Miss Americana is. It's just managing a different part of the image.
Managing this idea of her as credible and as a songwriter and as more than just a pop star, even though the reason why we love her is because she can do both.
Before we go, I did also just want to mention very briefly, talking about moments in film that use old footage, like the Taylor one, to kind of like set a baseline. I did like in the Blackpink film how they used all the old audition footage. The part where I think it's Jennie is singing The Weeknd. I love the idea that like in 2015, they're like, I used to sing dark songs. And like, look at me now. Look at what we do. Look at these. Da, 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 da. Look at that. Given how systemic that K-pop training system is, the idea that they just kind of like stripped it down and were like, yeah, we're going to show you the raw footage from back in the day, I really enjoyed.
I have one question for you about the Blackpink film, John, just out of pure curiosity. What do you think about the way all of the girls are introduced by Teddy? He sort of gives a little précis of who each different band member is and like what their personality traits are before we actually kind of hear them describe themselves in their own words and before we get a little segment on each of them.
I thought that was an unusual choice, but I think it reflects a couple things. One, Teddy as a figure at YG and in K-pop in general is such a kind of legendary, iconic figure. I can imagine the mind state of the folks who are making this film, understanding the power that Teddy wields in terms of the creative sound of that entire industry, really. And so I think if you're super inside the industry, Teddy is a voice of authority. It's unproblematic that he would be the person to introduce them rather than them introducing themselves. From the outside, I agree. It scans a little weird that we're 10 to 15 minutes into the film. No one's been introduced. And then you have Teddy. And if you don't know who he is, you just think he's the guy in the studio. You're like, why is the guy in the studio telling me all this? I think it made some sense from the inside, but from the outside, I think it made a little bit less sense. What'd you make of it?
I understood how important he was to the band. I just thought it was an interesting choice to kind of have him tee them up in that way. And I guess because I knew less about them.
Did it seem odd to basically like have a man introduce them as opposed to having them introduce themselves in this film about an empowered female group?
Yeah, a little bit. And also just the way they seem to be boiled down to a couple of character traits. You know, you have Lisa is, you know, had a more kind of traditional stage mum managing kind of background. And, you know, there's like the smart one and the fun one and the optimist. And like, it was interesting to me that they were introduced in that way. It felt kind of Spice Girls to me.
Yeah, it felt like fan service. Like that was the most fan servicey to me part of the film. Because, you know, when you stay in a group like Blackpink, you identify with someone. I agree. It has like real Spice Girls energy. And it felt kind of like, you know, like the revealing of everybody's a superhero and you're revealing their talents. It did have that kind of sense of like, if you're into A and B, Jennie's for you. If you're into C and D, you're a Lisa stan. But as a Jisoo stan, Ian, tell me anything I did not already know. Simran, what a joy to have you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Karen's going to be here in a minute. Let's listen to a little bit of OG Blackpink. This is Whistle.
Hey, boy. Make him whistle like a missile. Bomb, bomb. Every time I show up, blow up. Make him whistle like a missile. Bomb, bomb. Every time I show up, blow up. In the moon.
We are back. Karen is here.
Hello, John.
Simran and I were just talking about all these films. Obviously, we talked about the Demi doc. We knew if we were talking about Demi, we had to tap in Demi peak Ganscore pop edition. Yeah?
Oh, totally. In fact, side note, I mentioned to Demi how much we love Ashley Simpson, and she said, me too.
Demi should be listening to the Ashley episodes.
I mean, if I was directly in touch with her, which I am not, people have reached out to me because they think I am. The internet is such a funny place. I'm not.
Leave Karen alone. Leave Karen alone.
Not in touch, but I would tell her to listen to that. And also, one other nugget, I asked her if she would ever consider returning to that sound, you know, that pop punky sound of her early records or doing something like that. And she said, yes, she and some friends are considering a side project.
glad to hear it. Also, as someone who wrote a very early and prophetic Demi Lovato feature.
You did.
In 2009, I think. Yeah. Yep. Very proud of that story. Everybody go read that story. Very proud of that story. Karen profiled Demi for the cover of A&L, came out a week ago. I wanted to talk, Karen, about the function of documentary in the Demi Lovato, redemption is not quite right, reemergence narrative. Because I think it's one thing for her to do an interview with you or any of these other publications and be like, I went through whatever. I went through a drug overdose. I almost died. I'm the victim of sexual assault. It's one thing to say that to a journalist and have it become kind of like the clickbait pull quote, right? It's another thing to say, I'm going to say it on my terms in a documentary project that I think she's an executive producer, you know, that I'm in charge of. What do you make of the decision to do a documentary for this specific moment in the Demi Lovato reemergence?
Well, keep in mind, Demi Lovato is a fan of the documentary format. This is not her first one. So the one right before this, it was in 2017. It was called Simply Complicated. And while the current documentary focuses on her relapse and overdose and where she is now, the one in 2017 was meant to cover basically everything that happened before that. And keep in mind, she's been in show business for a very long time. And the first half of her career, not half, but the first part of her career had many controversies and things that people would be curious about in a more gossipy way, drug use, you know, things of that nature. And I felt like this wasn't vastly different from Simply Complicated in that it achieved the same purpose, which was like, this was a complicated, truly a complicated young person with a lot of story to tell. And something about Demi is like, she does talk a lot to journalists. She shares her story a lot. She's on social media. She's definitely out there, but there is definitely something about that documentary format, I think, that appeals to her. Now, in addition to that 2017 one, I believe there's a 2012 one that she made that she didn't make, MTV made, which was when she came out of rehab the first time. She was in rehab in 2010.
Oh, and wow. I don't think I've ever seen that.
That she has since said in the 2017 documentary, she admitted that while she was speaking about her sobriety in that MTV documentary, she was high. So as a documentary, it's not a portrait of the truth. And I don't think she really considers that. And I don't believe that she had creative control. It was an MTV project. So I think she doesn't really consider that part of her documentary oeuvre. But in terms of using it now to tell such a complicated story, I found it useful because as much as I can paint a picture myself with my words about what happened to her, there really isn't a replacement for watching her say it herself. And having watched the documentary yourself, I mean, I'm sure you found the same thing. I watched the first 10 minutes and I felt like my chest was tight.
I had been meaning to watch it, and I finally watched it last night, but I didn't end up starting it until after midnight. And I was so frustrated because I was like, I can't text Karen right now. Like, it's too late to text Karen and be like, holy shit. You know, like, this is intense. And I felt that gut kick over and over and over again, especially in those first two episodes. I really, really felt that. Look, I am used to pop stars leveraging their personal challenges or struggles for publicity purposes. That's just like a normal part of like our work. There's a little bit of that in this, and I'll get to that in a minute, but like the directness, the transparency, the kind of like, I'm just going to lay it out there-ness of this film was really raw, really, really raw. And really, you know, jolted me up off my couch, you know, at like 12:45. You know, I was is a lot. This is a lot to process. I did have a little bit of a I'm being sold the narrativeness. And I think the serialization of it, where it's like a little cliffhangery week to week or episode to episode, there's a little bit of that. Obviously, and we talked about this in the earlier segment, the kind of Scooter coming in with the heroic narrative. You know, the fact that she only wants to be managed by Scooter and that Scooter kind of comes in as a savior figure, like it's a little clean in that regard. But just in terms of the depth of the truth laid bare, I thought was very striking.
I agree. It should also be noted that in the 2017 documentary does focus heavily on her relationship with her former management team because they were largely responsible.
Remind people of the energy of that.
So that management team, they'd been with her since her earliest days in show business. They were the Jonas Brothers management team. And they seemed, you know, deeply concerned about her health. But at that point, it seemed like the solution to these problems was to put her into stricter and stricter situations in order to control the things that were out of control, which were she was struggling with an eating disorder and with drug addiction. The vibe of the 2017 documentary is that it was like a loving paternal kind of relationship, but it was a heavy hand. You felt like they had a very, very large role in her life and career. And what I was struck by in the second one was that Scooter seemed sort of like floating in the ether, like 20 feet above, like, look, I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm not going to guide you with a steady hand, but I'm going to be here to make sure that you don't screw up and that we make sure that you feel like you're living with enough freedom that you're not being forced to be screwed up.
I will admit, and I've spent enough time around Scooter, I feel like I have like a little bit of a grip on him. I did like the kind of first thing that he says, which is basically like, we were ready to say no, we're taking the meeting, kind of like to be polite, we knew who we were going to recommend. And I was like, that's true. Like, that feels really true to me. Like, and that's true not just to Scooter, but like, that's how the business is. It's like, we'll take this meeting, we'll glad hand you, we'll be polite, and then we'll punch you and make you somebody else's problem. You know, that felt very real to me. It sort of was like a kind of offhand moment, but it did feel very, very accurate to my perceptions of the music business.
I believe that too. And while he definitely does play a role in that, in the second film, I don't know. I mean, like, it's a lighter one.
Yes, absolutely.
The emphasis is more on sort of her writing her own story, being in control of her story, taking more control over her life, which has sort of been the primary issue for her over all the years.
Let's actually listen to Demi at the Grammys performing Anyone.
I used to crave the world's attention. I think I cried too many times. I just need some more affection. Anything to get me by. 100 million stories and 100 million songs. I feel stupid when I sing. Nobody's listening to me.
Did this documentary at all feel about Demi's music? Obviously, there is music in it, and we're, you know, she alludes there's the big Grammys performance and so on and so forth. But it doesn't really feel like a documentary about music. It's a documentary about a person who's been through a tremendous amount of trauma. Music is very much like a side thing.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think it's about like what the music industry has helped do to her and less about the music that she has made. The last segment, she talks a bit about the album that's going to come out this week, Dancing with the Devil, The Artist Starting Over, which covers both of those things, the relapse and the sort of, and the future. But no, it's not like a deep exploration of like the Demi Lovato creative process. There was a lot more of that in the 2017 doc, which showed her more in the studio, being a perfectionist. There's a little bit of that, I think, at the end of this one. But it was more part of the narrative before, sort of like trying to explain what kind of artist she is. And there's definitely less of that in Dancing with the Devil.
When I was thinking about the kind of like taxonomy of these films, right? Like I was thinking of the Demi thing and the Bieber YouTube series kind of being hand in hand, which is to say that they are, forgive for the people who listened to this earlier, they're basically just behind the musics. Like they're just behind the musics, but they're made by the artist and the artist team. And they're made at a much earlier phase in the career rather than like waiting till they're in their 40s to revisit and say, hey, you want to know something that I didn't tell you about in my 20s? Like, here's something I didn't tell you. Instead, it's just woven into the narrative. I find it powerful. Maybe I'm a sucker for it, but I find it powerful because I'm someone who pays close attention and I want to know the full complexity of the people who I'm listening to. Like, I don't want to feel like I don't have access to some intimate private struggle, you know, like I want to understand.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that's why people read into Lemonade as heavily as they did. You know, Beyonce doesn't share that much about her creative process or what's the story behind the songs. So, of course, everybody took it as gospel. Obviously, she's having marital problems. This is what she's singing about in Lemonade. She never confirmed really or denied anything. We were using context clues and gossip things, you know, whatever to make it happen. But yeah, people do so desperately crave to know what the story is behind the song. If I'm identifying with this and it means so much to me, I want to know, what did it mean to the person who made it? What if it means something completely different?
Although what's interesting about the fact that you get these kind of like deep dive personal trauma things from performers in their 20s, or well, I guess for both Bieber and Demi in this case, are both in their 20s. What's left after that? Like, what could a documentary in their 30s or 40s be about? You know, it's like that arc that used to be like the kind of 30-year arc of like lived experience to reassessment or behind the scenesness. Now it's just all compressed. And obviously that's partially because the shift to streaming has created these heavy hitter platforms that have money to spend and they want to spend it on pop content. And so they're encouraging this sort of content because it's going to be very, very sticky for viewers and listeners. But it's also like there's so much scrutiny every day now for young pop stars that like you almost have to fold in your struggles and trauma to your public presentation. You almost have to fold it in now because it's not like it was in the 80s or God forbid the 70s or 60s where like you could effectively hide all the struggle stuff. Odds are if you're going through something rough, it's going to creep out in some way now, whether something you post on your own social media or something someone else posts about you on social media, you're not as in control of that broader narrative. So I guess it makes sense that younger artists are arriving at like the tell-all phase much earlier than they had in the past.
I think that's true. I think a couple of related points. I think like, you know, number one, a lot of artists are basically making their own documentaries day to day on all their social media platforms. So just the facility and the, you know, familiarity with the format, it's a lot easier for somebody like Demi to sit and speak directly to camera and tell her darkest secrets about the lowest points of her life because people do that all day, every day now. It's just a very familiar thing. The second thing I would say is that so many artists died at 27, right? Or before, and didn't even get a chance to make this kind of documentary and have this arc. So, you know, like there is no Cobain story exactly like this because you don't get to even get to the other side. I mean, obviously Bieber and Demi have both been through a lot and I hope that their 30s are wildly uneventful. And that the documentary they're making in their 40s is about how they cruised for like 15 years after their troubles and, you know, got to the other side.
Yeah, I hope it's really whack. Like, I hope they just make like a super whack documentary when they're 40. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Like, just like boring as hell. And what you're saying basically is Cobain never had a scooter.
It's true. Can you imagine Cobain and Scooter talking to each other? My God.
That's the movie I'm going to quit the New York Times to write. That's the film.
There's a lot going on here I can't even absorb. I'm sure you talked about this in the earlier segment, but like, you know, the idea that so many of these pop stars making these documentaries that are mostly marketing vehicles above anything else have to manufacture tension or create some sort of problem. But, you know, you press play on the Demi one and you're like, there's nothing needed to be embellished or invented here.
Yeah, for sure. We talked about that with Simran and the notion that these are young stars who are in essence kind of in control of their own tension at this point. They're writing the narrative and including that tension already.
Also, did you talk about Truth or Dare?
We didn't talk about Truth or Dare, but if you would like to talk about Truth or Dare, it would bring me joy to close out with Truth or Dare. I only brought it up briefly in reference to the Ariana film, where I was basically like, all the like side folks and, you know, dancers and whatever, like, you know, I think they think they're shooting Truth or Dare, but they are not actually shooting.
Well, it is funny in general. I mean, not in the Demi doc, but in other ones of this, you know, ilk, where the glimpses you get of the people around the star are always almost as revealing as they are the star, you know, themselves. The Kevin Costner moment in Truth or Dare will live forever.
Oh my God, legend.
Live in infamy for using the word neat around her. But, you know, just like you thought we were going to get through a pop star documentary podcast and I wasn't going to bring up Truth or Dare, you know, you're crazy. Truly, truly art. And obviously this provides Pedro a moment to share his Madonna story.
Oh, bring it.
There were no cameras rolling. I'll keep it short because I think I've mentioned this before. But Madonna and I, we had a bit of a Donnybrook in 1984. So, yeah, she's a bit of a sore mouth, as am I. So we
Madonna we come on podcast challenge.
Oh, I guarantee you, she absolutely doesn't remember this story. And I, you know, this is my brush with, you know, big time fame. So yeah, we cussed each other out at a concert, a Frankie Goes to Hollywood concert. Wow. So we're talking like way back in
the '80s. Pedro, relax.
Yes, relax. But I did it. I relaxed and I did it. We exchanged some words and punches were thrown, and that's all I'm going to say about that.
Wait, Madonna punched you?
Yes, oh, come she took on. A swing.
It's a great story.
I don't know if you guys remember the DJ Jellybean Benitez, oh, yes. That tiny little guy. He just sat there. He didn't do a thing. It looked like this wasn't the first time that she was brawling with people at a club. So,
Pedro, I want you to tell this story at the end of every single podcast every moving ahead. So that's basically why I brought it up.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Anytime we talk about truth or dare, what's going
to
happen.
I guess so we have no choice now but to go out on Madonna's Express Yourself. So I guess what I'll say is thank you, Karen. Thank you to Simran. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us podcast@nytimes. Get on the Facebook group. Get in the Discord. Hell, tell me about the Discord because I haven't been in it yet, but I'm sure it's popping. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google, etc. Our producer is the pugnacious Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Express Yourself, Madonna, Blonde Ambition. Let's go.